We recorded this episode of Geek Speak on June 15th, 2015, in Los Gatos, California. And stay tuned after this broadcast edition for a special podcast bonus, my interview with Neil Stephenson. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, June 20th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on Central Coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 889 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm at Lyle on Twitter. And with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and a computer graphics artist. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Lyle. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, and traveler, and also a bit of a music geek, I would say.
Yeah, definitely a music geek. My Twitter handle is very, very boring.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. I tweet maybe once a year.
Okay.
Ben Jaffe.
I tweet all the time.
Do you really?
Kind of annoyingly so. I actually isolate my social networks on different things that are of different regions of importance, right? So, like my gardening and my kids' stuff go on Facebook, of course, because it's a little more selective. And then my tech stuff go on Twitter. And then my Google Glass stuff goes on Google Plus.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, let's have some corrections, because last week, Ben, you and I chatted a lot about the Batterizer. Batterizer, we tried to describe how it worked and all that stuff. You want to give a brief on what it is?
Yeah, it's a voltage booster that they're claiming can increase the life of standard household batteries by 5 to 8 times.
That seems large.
Now, us covering the story was actually an elaborate plot to see how many of our listeners had BS detectors.
No, this is like a normal AA, AAA, whatever battery.
Yeah.
That you stick this little cap over it, and what it does is it takes the lower voltage and boosts it up to a higher voltage, thereby letting it last longer. And some electronics that actually care about the voltage level, trading out, of course, by current. And I described that really well last week. But the claim was what we kind of just glossed by, which we shouldn't have.
Yeah, I did say they claim that blah, 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 blah. And their claim is that you could take your battery and increase its life by 5 times to 8 times,
now,
which is huge.
Well, now, wait a second. We all use devices that have all this battery needs, and there's so much research going into batteries. Surely there's these huge, huge steps that are being taken to increase the battery life. I mean, our phones can do so much more and last so much longer than they used to. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
5 to 8 times, that almost sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
The thing is, if it was 5 to 8 times, why wouldn't the battery manufacturers just put that electronics in there?
Right.
Yeah. I think that's the problem.
Well, exactly.
I think it's true that if you took this thing and put it on the battery, it would show a voltage higher for a long time longer, but it doesn't mean there's any current that you could actually use from the battery.
Now, just to be clear, what the company is claiming is that the important thing of their technology is the miniaturization aspect, not so much the actual voltage boosting and all that stuff. We've had, you know, that capability for a very long time, just not necessarily as miniature. But there have been a number of articles that have run disputing the claims and trying to figure out, like, how could this feasibly be possible? And it turns out that, you know, maybe it does do something. Maybe it does boost the battery. And it would have been great if their marketing department had said, yeah, it might, on a good day, increase your battery life by about half. You know,
well,
make
that's
it
not
like
50%, that's really good.
Yeah, that's really good. And I would still go and buy a couple, but you know, they made some pretty lofty claims, which of course has made a lot of people made people doubt the entire company's, I guess, reason for existing and claims. And
it's starting to sound
stuff.
Like a perpetual motion machine.
It sounds like a scam. Yeah, it does.
I think we should recalibrate our detectors, because most battery technology seems to advance in small percentages, 5, 10, 15%, and in other ways, like a capacity or weight to power ratio. But but doubling a battery alone would be a massive improvement that would make headlines all across the world.
Yeah. 8 times, just imagine. So, apologies, we did not necessarily do the best job at reporting on that story, but we're doing a great job on reporting on it now.
so we're gonna time heals all errors, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So we're going to put a couple of great stories, one from eevblog.com and one from Neurologica. Do you recognize that
blog? Yes, I do.
That is Stephen Novella's blog. And
he handled that pretty well.
Yeah, and he hosts the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which I have not been listening to a lot recently, and perhaps it shows in my reporting on that.
Well, and on that podcast, they like to point out how correcting a lie usually makes that lie stick in people's head longer.
Well, that's right.
We just made it worse.
Well, maybe.
In fact, if you want to hear the episode where we interview Stephen Novella, the guy that does the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, it's the May 17th, 2008 episode of Geek Speak called The Skeptic's Guide with Geeks.
Man, so, he's been doing this for a very long time.
He has.
They have a lot of episodes out, and they're all pretty good.
Brian, tell us about ad blocking, sir.
So, we've had ad blocking for years now. In fact, there's a AdBlock Plus, AdBlock.
There's all these features that turn them off.
There's AdBlock, AdBlock Plus. We use those in our desktop browsers, and it's always been a bone of contention between the web, the websites which make their money off of all these advertisements, and us users who especially among the geeks of us, feel like we should be able to control the environment in our web browser.
Yeah, and it's also a little bit difficult because I definitely feel bad sometimes when I have AdBlock Plus turned on. I'm not. I have a much, much, much better experience on the web. But if I ever feel guilty enough to turn off AdBlock Plus, the amount of ads that get shoved in my face, probably partially because of people using ad blockers, they have to, you know, show more ads. It's a really nasty experience.
Do you think a lot of average users actually use ad blocking software? I mean, I'm assuming that mostly geeks do it.
It depends what you mean by average users. Ad blocking software on the desktop is the most popular browser extension of all.
Yeah. And it's very easy to install.
Just on Chrome, just in 2014, there was 40 million users of AdBlock, which is the most popular.
40 million, that's pretty That's pretty big.
I mean, it's not Facebook numbers, but that's a lot of numbers, especially for all these websites that are trying to advertise to the most engaged people, which in a lot of cases are these geeks.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
So this directly affects the bottom line of a commercial website that is exclusively making their living on these ads.
Now, you just denoted a website, desktop website version, meaning laptops and desktop computers for ad blocking. Is there options of ad blocking in other areas like mobile?
So I don't know about Android. Ben, has there been ad blocking on Android browsers for a while now?
I am not aware of it. I don't have any installed or anything, but I do know.
Well, you definitely could because you use like modded Android devices. Like, you use engine mods. You know, there's going to be someone that has done it.
Yeah, I'm sure it exists somewhere, but it's definitely not easy to install. You can't just open up Chrome on your Android device and go and install an extension.
In fact, extensions don't really exist like that
in
the mobile space. Yeah.
No.
So just last week, Apple had their developers conference.
The Worldwide Developers Conference. I was there, Brian. It was fun. I got a jacket and everything.
Yeah, a nice jacket. I like it.
Yeah,
it's a little lightweight, maybe kind of not appropriate for San Francisco when the fog comes in, just when the sun's out.
Yeah, that's true. And it was a very warm week. We'll talk about that a little later, though, on the show. So what did they announce?
So thanks to the opening up of WDC, we used to not be able to talk about any of this, but we can now talk about some of the announcements that they do, including there is now going to be in the next version of iOS a ability to put an extension in there that will be able to content filter going to the Safari web browser on the iPhone, on the iPad.
So, oh, wow.
Fundamentally, ad blocking is one form of content filtration. You're basically taking the stuff that goes into your web browser and you're deciding, yeah, this stays and this goes, right?
Yeah.
So this could be for ad blocking. It could also have other
translation
various uses.
Services potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, yeah. I mean, the thing is, when you modify an HTML document, which makes up web pages, the actual language is HTML, hypertext, markup language. When you modify that language by like saying to the browser, okay, even though you say there's an image here, don't get that image. Modify it so it's not image tag, you wouldn't load the image. Therefore, you would reduce bandwidth use on it. So there's other things that can occur if you modify the HTML on the fly, which is what these content filters do. So that's new for Apple. I'm surprised they're doing it. Why?
Well, they released a new architecture last year that allowed them to do extensions, and they seem to be just expanding that out into more and more areas.
Extending the extensions.
But there are many other motivations that you can read into this. They have a new news app that they're going to come out with in the next version of iOS, which will be similar to Flipboard and a few other apps out there. But some people see a nefarious purpose allowing ad blockers into mobile Safari, but now releasing their own news app, which they will be monetizing with the news providers.
Right. And sharing the revenue of that ad, the ads that they put in there.
Right.
Right.
Now, Apple has a history of trying to enforce tasteful ads, not the ones that get people riled up for the most part.
Yeah. And if it is extremely easy to turn off ads on the mobile device, then it requires people to make more restricted browsers. And you can do that by making native applications. So they put apps on the App Store that has a browser built in that actually doesn't have the full functionality like the plugin. Then all of a sudden, some mom and pop shop has an app, and that app, of course, would have ads served by Apple, so Apple gets a cut of it, and mom and pop shop still gets to have the ads revenue.
Well, just to be clear, the apps that go in the App Store don't have to use Apple's ad network.
But no, they do.
They certainly do make it easiest to use their ad network. So I've been reading several articles that I always see lots of news about ad blocking because, of course, the websites out there that put up articles also make their living on ads. So they tend to write stories about the world is ending when people start using ad blockers. But
I love that. All the newspapers like, that's our only revenue. Attack, attack.
So your point about this pushing people or organizations to make apps is a great point. So I started digging into what the percentage of people that use a mobile browser would be. And first of all, among mobile browsers, Safari is by and far the largest, over 50%.
In the U.S.?
Uh-huh. In the U.S. But when you actually take a look at the overall browser market between desktop and mobile, mobile is only 6.5%. The rest is desktop.
Right.
So we're talking about 3% of visiting a website is going to be affected by these ad blockers if everybody on iOS actually installed one of these one of these filters.
And additionally, those numbers are all about website access.
Right.
And of course, lots of times apps are actually website, but they wouldn't be counted as website access. They'd be counted as app access.
Mm-hmm. And
like the Amazon app, for example. It is a web page completely just wrapped in an Amazon application, and therefore that doesn't count as mobile web. It counts mobile applications.
And I don't know about you guys, but I don't sit there on my mobile browser hardly at all. Many apps. They're so much more efficient to get what I'm trying to get to.
For reading, maybe.
I could see it on a tablet. I don't own a tablet, but I could see myself browsing the web on a tablet.
Yeah.
Just not so much on a small screen, very small screen.
Well, let's talk about film for just a second and Kickstarters and our favorite universe. Ben?
Well, so tonight...
Well, secondary, actually. I like this universe a lot.
So I'll just start out by mentioning my plans tonight. I'm going to go home after a long day of work and then coming and recording this lovely podcast to try out a little 5-lumen LED projector. It's not actually 5 lumens, but it's really, really small and cheap and everything. And I'm going to project Star Trek on the wall.
Cool.
And watch some Star Trek. And that is what this story is about. This is about not the Next Generation, which I'll be watching tonight, but about the original series and our favorite Vulcan, Mr. Spock. So Leonard Nimoy, who played Mr. Spock on Star Trek, the original series, his son... is Adam Nimoy, and his son just started a Kickstarter for making a documentary about Mr. Spock and also about his dad, Leonard Nimoy, and his dad's art and everything. So just for those of us who are Star Trek fans, like me, I just wanted to give a little PSA that it exists. And
if you look for Spock documentary Kickstarter, you'll find it.
Or if you go on geekspeak.org.
Oh, geekspeak.org?
Yeah.
Hey, in fact, that's what you're listening to right now. This is Geekspeak. We are available on KOSP, of course. And we're also available on Twitter and Facebook. Our name is simply KOSP Geeks, because that is the radio station we're affiliated with. If you want to learn more about Geekspeak, anything we're talking about, go to geekspeak.org. We'll be back in just a second. You're listening to Geekspeak on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the Air Room is Mr. Ben Jaffe. Hey, Ben.
Thanks. Yo. For coming.
And Brian Young. Hey, Brian.
Howdy.
And I want to talk with you guys and with everybody a bit about what's happened to us in the last month of
what's happened to
tech
us?
Workshops.
Well, we've you make it sound so unpleasant.
I would say pleasant, but our experiences in the Silicon Valley conference spectacular that we happen to live in. You went to I/O, Google I/O, which is the developer conference for Google. Yep.
In Moscone West,
which is the same place I was last week at WWDC. Which is
Apple's.
Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. And they're about 2 weeks apart from each other, actually.
Yeah. But it's interesting. It was interesting being at I/O and kind of like seeing, like they're pretty decadent with their decorations. They had this custom carpet on the walls and everything like that. And just thinking like, all right, so at the end of this weekend, they're going to tear all of this down and then they're going to put up Apple, you know, stuff and do WWDC in the same exact venue. It's just kind of crazy.
Kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. It's a good venue for that kind of thing.
I got to say, this is the first time I've gone to WWDC. And in going in the, early in the morning on Monday to go see the keynote, which I've been watching for years, right? Just streaming it or watching it later even. Sometimes they didn't have it live. But I was going to be in the room. I was kind of excited about it. And I felt I was split between this experience of, cool, I get to be in the center of what's happening in the tech industry, what we'll be talking about on shows like this for a week or two, and also feeling a bit like a lemming, you know, just following the crowd. I mean, one thing that struck me, so getting in line, standing out line for quite a while, getting my badge, then standing in line again to get into this place, and then we're herded up multiple levels of escalators, and as we go
you get to the top floor,
I waited in the middle floor for a long time. We kind of got corralled into sections, but one of the things that happened is that getting off the escalator at one point, there was probably 20 to 30 employees with blue shirts that were Apple employees applauding as we went through, like they were applauding us.
That is so strange.
It was like a carnival kind of.
So wait a second, company.
What are you doing
with everybody in the line there? With the energy and the excitement to get in the room, it still felt odd. It still felt like
Maybe I have too much. You know, maybe I'm doing too much analysis of the moment in my mind. I'm a geek. Right. I tend to do that.
But you're also a theater nerd. So
I'm also. It's also like going to San Francisco is not like, ooh, I'm in San Francisco. You know, I live here. Like this is where I live. So I've gone to San Francisco all my life. I've been in that conference center tons of times. I worked a show there once. You know, it's like some regards, I'm not the best person to experience that. So anyway, we walk through this plaza. Then we stand in a crowded environment for, I don't know, half an hour, just standing. There's hundreds of us, thousands of us. And so I finally sat down at one point. And as I'm sitting there, I'm looking around me, and it's 90% white men in there, you know, under 40. I'm like an oddity because I happen to be over 40, right? But there's just, it's such a disgusting situation. And when you're in that kind of environment at conferences, you see how bad the diversity is in tech.
It's diversity and it's also privilege, right?
Go hand in hand.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It was similar at I/O, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it wasn't as stark as what I'm hearing from you, but definitely there was a kind of discrepancy with what was happening just inside the building and just outside the building, right? So there's, you know, homeless people. And they kicked the homeless people out for the first day when they were letting people in and doing the badging and all that stuff, which makes sense from their perspective. But,
it's a public street.
It's really strange to see that so close.
And so I feel a little weird and awkward. Oh, the other thing they gave us right away is this jacket, right, that says WWDC and 15 on the back. And so a lot of people put them on. I stuffed mine in my bag. So I was glad it was lightweight. But I guess the thought is, so being in that and being just so blatantly that problem. Additionally, Apple actually has a process where they can't give everybody that wants a ticket. So there's an auction.
Yeah, similar with I/O.
Yeah,
there's way too much demand. Everyone wants in, and there's just not enough space.
I applied for an I/O ticket. I didn't get one. I applied for WC. I happened to get one, but I'm with a group of colleagues, about 20 people. Two of us got them, right? So it's like extremely hard to get into this thing.
Oh, wow.
And then when I'm sitting there thinking about how bad the diversity is, I thought, well, could Apple just say, people that are not the standard white guy in their 20s, you have a 80% higher chance of getting a ticket. I mean,
you have to ask.
You have to ask and you have to invest and then you have to figure out like who do you have to do self-declaration? Because, of course, identity is personal. So gender and race is all really the person's, the human being that is choosing to be that, to declare that way. That's how they declare. You know, it's like not like you can, there's not some scientific way to say, if you're a diverse member or not of society.
Right, and then you get into gaming the system.
Yeah, potentially. But I thought, even if they just said it costs more money if you're, a white guy from 20 to 40, it costs more money, or you have less chance, that still would affect the overall numbers. Anyway, so I just had that thought and tweeted that and got a bit of discussion around that this week.
It's funny. I read that same tweet and I got a totally different meaning out of what you said.
Oh, what do you think?
Because
It is a tweet.
So it's open to interpretation. You were talking about how you're looking around it. You were talking about how you have in the past worn Google Glass, and that with Google Glass,
I wrote a whole blog post about that.
Yeah. And that I thought this was really clever because you talked about how when you wore Google Glass, yes, there was all the people that had their privacy concerns, but at the same time, you invariably ended up into a discussion with them and them trying the glass on
and
so on,
and then having detailed conversations about privacy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now you and then here you are at a Apple event, not wearing Google Glass, looking right. around at everybody, just staring down at their phones, not talking to everybody.
Right. Everybody engaged with a social service that they've obviously signed off all their privacy on, right? Like Facebook says, those images are mine, you know? And so all these people around me are doing the exact same thing, but there's no dialogue about it, really. So Glass did provide a dialogue in some ways. Yes, those were my two discussions while sitting in this mob of tech people. Those are the two thoughts that went through my mind, at least at WWDC. Now, the actual conference, I can't actually talk about some things, right? They do say you're not allowed to talk about these things.
So why exactly do they do that?
Well, they do it for a very smart purpose. One of Apple's major things they do, of course, is build APIs, application programming interfaces, mm-hmm. and language modifications, and SDKs. This is a SDK.
Software development kit.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Nicely done. And they produce these things and then give them to people to use to develop software. When they are introducing a new feature, sometimes it's not completely what will be final. It's beta.
So it's half-baked, maybe.
I wouldn't say half-baked. I'd call it beta. You
okay,
know?
So it's beta, but could be still changed, could be buggy, could be
if people start using exactly what they're saying at this day, and then when the final comes out and someone's written up a whole, this is how you use this feature, but then 6 months later it's different, all of a sudden there's all this information that's wrong and people are confused, and that's part of it, I think.
Have a history of pulling features out right at the very end as well.
That's right, and modifying things right off, you know, let those change something. And of course the whole point of the beta program is to get feedback from developers. So if something's really wrong, that's when you want to change it. So that when you tell everybody, it's fixed, theoretically.
So in the past, they were really clear that the only thing you could speak about is what they talked about publicly, which was the keynote. However, they have loosened this up in recent years. And
they were streaming a lot of the sessions.
They're freely available even without a developer account now.
Yeah, they really changed up things.
And so it allows us to talk about what is coming without... what we're not allowed to talk about is to review it as if it is done.
And the language details.
Exactly.
Right? So they talk about Swift. Swift's the new programming language they actually released last year at WWDC, Apple did, and that was just Swift, and now the new one is called Swift 2. And the thing I thought was the most interesting at the conference from a programmer perspective is that one of the lead developers, and I don't have his name in front of me, and I don't even know if these slides were public, so I'm going to talk loosely about it. He chatted about modifying Swift 1 to Swift 2 and actual modifying the language. He works on the compiler. And really, I thought that was fascinating because normally you don't see a language develop in a public way unless you're really engaged in the development of it. But I got to see, you know, he was just talking about how you call functions in Swift 1 versus Swift 2, naming them or not.
Was that the lead developer, Chris Lattner?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. See, we know who is the native iOS developer in the house. That would be Brian. Android guy over there, and I'm a web developer. No, that's not really fair.
No.
That's not really fair at all. So I thought that was fascinating. And, you know, I know a lot about language modification because JavaScript's been changing for years, but I have a lot invested in that discussion, right? When you talk about traditional class inheritance being put into JavaScript, I have an opinion. And right off the bat, not like, is this good or bad, but more like, no, that's wrong. You're changing my baby, like completely emotional. So seeing the language dissected intellectually without having a lot invested in it was just intriguing and cool. And it was one of those times where it's like, oh, this is staged, you know, in the sense that he's on stage and he has slides, but he cares about what he's saying and he's describing what they were thinking. And that's not what I normally see around Apple, because I normally see the marketing pressy release, and I like that a lot. I want to see more of that. Apple, people, share more what you're thinking and feeling when you create, please.
Hmm.
Anything from I.O. you want to cover? Because we did talk about it before.
Yeah, we talked about it a bit. Yeah, actually, I think I covered a good amount in the last show. But...
So the week of WWDC, I only went half the week, because the second week I went to NodeConf, and Node is a JavaScript server-side JavaScript engine.
Right. So like a lot of previously we would think of JavaScript as the language which runs in your browser.
That's right.
In Google Chrome or Firefox or IE or Opera or Safari. I guess I didn't need to name all five of them, but
that
in your
good,
web browser,
I'm impressed.
I guess I'm a web developer.
And so Node
lets it run on the server. So the server would be where your photos on Facebook are actually stored, or where your information is stored when you log into a service or anything like that. Those are the things that are in data center somewhere. And previously you would run Python on them, or you'd run PHP on them or some other language. And now you can run JavaScript with Node.js. It's been around for a while.
Yeah, definitely.
So NodeConf.
We've talked about Node in more detail on former episodes of Geek Speak. We had Dan Shaw on, and we had Michael Rogers on chatting about this. So you can look up, I think, July 19, 2014, talked a lot about Node on
YouTube. You just have all of the shows memorized?
You know how I do, man. And, I mean, it's part of my life, right? In any case, the conference that I went to is a camping conference. The entire family went, and we all camped out.
Oh, you went camping?
Yeah, we went camping.
You went camping and talked about Node?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really cool. It's cool every year. I just totally love it. But one of the things that came up with the Node conference, NodeConf, was a lot about diversity and the lack thereof. And this group of people, I think, is fantastic. Because even though the problems of diversity are severe throughout the tech industry, the discussions we had around what the Node Foundation should do about it and what kind of guidance they should put upon the community was informative, respectful, just great. I mean, so, it was really, really wonderful to see that kind of emerge.
So the Node community just in general just is very embracing of diversity and trying to get more people in there that are from different backgrounds?
I would say it would like to be, but any tech industry is not, right? I mean, there's like eight people that are the core Node developers. These are all open source people that develop the core. They are all white men, okay? Mm-hmm. At the same time, yes, I think the community in general is very respectful and open to a lot of people, and that's still a problem. Like, there's still a problem.
So we've talked about this personally before. About
and of
like,
course,
how do you do this? How do you get more women, more right. people of color, more people involved? That and when you just look around and all you see is white men.
Yeah. It's not a good. I mean, of course, and this is a perfectly bad example of us doing this because here we are, three right. white men talking about diversity. It's
well,
just
yeah,
stupid.
I just wanted to say on air, like, we've had so many conversations about, like, how do we do more outreach for specific groups so that we actually have more diversity in our voices. Right?
Are you talking about Udacity? Yeah.
No, I'm talking about Geekspeak.
That's true.
Yeah, it's just difficult. You know, it's a very difficult thing, and it's not because it's it being difficult means it doesn't mean anything. You still have to focus on it more. You actually have to focus on it more rather than just letting it happen. Because if you let it happen, it won't happen.
Well, it is interesting because the iOS and the Apple developer community sounds pretty similar to what you're talking about with the Node community. There's mm-hmm. still a paltry size or a paltry amount of women coming into the community. But they're actually doing some things. One of the well-known developers went out and made something called App Camp for Girls, and it's
right,
now spreading across the country into cities that they're able to organize it in. So these kind of things are fantastic, but it takes a long time to take hold and see the effects of.
Yeah. One of the things we talked a lot about at the NodeConf, the workshops was around diversity, was this idea that part of the problem is that people don't know the problem exists. They really don't understand it. And mm-hmm. that's a common – I think that the three of us probably are pretty aware of the boundaries and borders that come up when the way we talk. And we try to make it more inclusive, but of course we can't do that very well. I mean, in general, a lot of people are completely unaware what privilege really means, and therefore they don't understand that they have it. And that was a big discussion, like, how do we can we educate people that are part of this community to understand what privilege is so at least they're aware of it? The great one is the idea that, like, I was sitting in this diversity thing and I didn't say anything. And mostly because I didn't say anything because I realized that there's enough guys talking.
You wanted to leave some space for someone else?
I just kept quiet the entire time. And sure enough, you know me, I don't do that very easily. So it was nice to see myself just sit quiet. And sure enough, everything I was going to say, at some point somebody said, I was good, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I'll help out in other ways in writing things up. But I don't know. After seeing the Apple event and seeing that there's this just disgusting problem, and of course, Apple's focus is making profit. When you see an open source community, they have the disgusting problem, but they're tackling it head on. That is the difference between, for me, a corporation moving something forward and a foundation, a movement of volunteers moving forward. So it was nice to see that. And Node's growing faster than Apple is in some ways, right? So, maybe not.
This is funny how the discussions fall into comparison, because this is totally not fair to either Node or Apple, I would say. But in the community around Apple, there was a big hubbub that they actually had two women VPs that were in the keynote.
On stage talking
about their technologies that their group is doing. So this is the way they do their keynotes, is the person who's most responsible for the technology, the one that's heading up the group, is the one that comes up and talks about it. So it wasn't just a figurehead. It wasn't just somebody plucked out of the lower ranks to come up and talk. So that was progress.
Because definitely modeling examples of leadership is a crucial piece, you know. for people to see that they can also be a part of that community.
Yeah, so it's interesting. At least one of those executives was somebody that has been in the company for years and years and years. It's just this is now the time that we're seeing them.
Mm-hmm. And never did a keynote themselves.
Exactly.
Right.
Hmm. And I mean, this is a problem in a number of different communities. The gaming community also has had, a much worse problem because I think fewer of the people who are loud in that community acknowledge that there's a problem.
Hey, Ben, can we talk about Udacity for a second?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You have free courses, like anyone can take these courses about technology. Is it mostly men or mostly women that take these courses? Like, do you see a little bit of that?
No, gosh, I wish I'd known you were going to ask me about this because
you probably have numbers.
I'd pull up numbers. No, but my coworkers and I do a lot of thinking about how to get people who are not just privileged males in this country, in America, or in the United States, I should say, into our courses and learning, right? Mm-hmm. So that goes for women, that goes for people in other countries where they may not have as much socioeconomic privilege. One of the things that Sebastian Thrun, the guy who started Udacity, found when he put his Stanford class online was that of all of the people who took the final exam, it was like number 400 and something was his top Stanford student. All of the people who took the class online did a lot of people did better than the top Stanford students, which kind of implied that
I'm sorry, go back to this.
Yeah.
So he had this course and it was designed it while he was doing it at Stanford.
Yeah.
Then he takes it and he puts it publicly, and the actual quality of the people that did a good job on the course, more of them existed outside of Stanford than inside Stanford. Is that?
I don't know about that very last thing you said, but yeah, a very, very, very large number of, the top students were not the Stanford students.
Okay, that's the best way to
explain
it.
The top students were the people who were outside of Stanford who were taking the same final exam in the same way.
Yeah, cool.
All of the students took the final exam the same way. And actually, Sebastian gave a talk at Google I.O. where he kind of talked about that. And a little bit more of the history, so you could we'll post that up on geekspeak.org as well.
So I won't be a geek if I don't get pedantic for you just a second to possibly explain that. Stanford students have a large course load. A person taking that course by themselves might only have one course, and therefore they potentially could do better just because of that.
That's true, but they also may not have they may not have the time to dedicate.
Right.
Full resources.
We have no idea what
they're
doing.
So these are just people who are just taking a course. I mean, they could be in their 40s with a bunch of kids and, you know, a full-time job. And I mean, it's, so that's a good thing to point out. But I guess the point that I take away from that is that the people who are at the top in our universities are not necessarily the people who are best at what they're studying or who will do the best at what they're studying, right? We have to be a little broader than that in terms of who we reach out to, who we enable to learn, right?
And just to be fair, though Udacity has these courses, these free courses, there's actually a lot of other resources out there as well.
Absolutely.
Don't want it to sound like an ad for. Can you give some competitors?
Code Academy, Coursera, Udemy, Udacity. There's a whole bunch of them.
Really
edX.
Cool. Very cool.
And honestly, I want all those companies to succeed. I don't want just Udacity to succeed. I want to see education reformed and democratized as much as possible so people can learn. Yeah.
Get better.
And boost themselves up.
There's also a lot of radio shows out there, but you happen to be listening to GeekSpeak on KOSP. This is 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. We'll be right back with discussions about LastPass, SpaceX, tiny robots, and, of course, a little bit more about privacy. Stay with us, won't you? You're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. If you'd like to communicate with us, ask us questions, learn more about what we're talking about, and all those things, first you can go to geekspeak.org to hear about all the stuff we talk about on the show. We have links and more discussions and all that. But you can also participate with us at Facebook and Twitter. Just go to KUSP Geeks. We're all one word, KUSP Geeks on Facebook and Twitter. Now, this is GeekSpeak, and we're going to talk now about passwords because, gosh, we need to talk about passwords.
Yeah, Brian, you and I have been covering a lot of stories. Lyle, you got one.
Yes, and that's Ben Jaffe, and Brian Young's with me as well, and I'm Lyle. So I actually use a password management tool called 1Password, and the reason I use that is that long ago I realized there's no way I can remember hundreds of passwords that are all unique and not, you know, aren't shared between services. Mm-hmm. It's impossible.
Yeah.
So at first I started using paper and write things down on paper, but then I'd jump in a lake and my wallet would be destroyed and my paper would be destroyed. So that's not good.
Did you really do that?
No. So then I started using an encrypted tool that I built myself. But that's actually really hard to use because I'd have to build it all. So that's
it also good. Sounds really dangerous because, you know,
I used a good encryption algorithm. So I didn't use somebody
else's.
No.
I mean, it's dangerous in that anything that one person builds will have tons of bugs in it,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. So there's these great services out there, and we actually talk about them a lot. 1Password is the one I use. There's also this one called LastPass. And what they basically do is 1Password is local to your computer. You put all your passwords in this system, and you to unencrypt the system, you have to put in a long passphrase. You have to know 1Password, right? And LastPass is the same thing, except for that giant blob of all your passwords goes on the LastPass service. It's a website.
Mm-hmm. So the advantage of that is that you can access it from your work computer, your home computer, your mobile device, because the vault doesn't live on one device of yours. It lives on their cloud services.
Well, just to be clear, 1Password has a system that can do that as well. It's just that it's not run by the 1Password organization. They use Dropbox for their sync tool.
Right.
Yeah, or you can use a number of services, but Dropbox is an easy one to get set up.
And you can also use WebDAV if you're a geek, and that's what I do. So my 1Password vault is not trusted by anybody else except for myself. I have it on my own server, and it syncs and all that. But cool. LastPass is another great service. And I also think that LastPass recently, unfortunately, announced on their blog that their service was hacked. And that's not the thing you want to do when you hear that they have all your passwords, right? Luckily, it's not as bad as it sounds. If you have LastPass, don't worry that much.
It's not nearly as bad as it sounds.
Right.
But it's still bad. Meh.
Yeah.
So wait. They have all of people's passwords, right? They're all just sitting right there on the LastPass service.
No, they don't. And that's the thing that's so cool about what the services use. Remember I said there was a long password that encrypts my vault? I like, Ben, that you called it a vault. Mm-hmm. That's a great way to think about it. It's basically a text document that gets encrypted by a large passphrase. That thing I have to know. It's over 20 characters long. It's random. It's something I'm pretty proud of knowing because no one else does.
Yeah. Now, the difference really quickly between a bank vault analogy and this kind of vault analogy is the bank vault. If you manage to somehow open up the vault, everything in
with
there
the blowtorch,
is just
whatever.
Right there. Yeah, it's all right there, and you just grab your money and
but
you go.
But this vault, the only way to open it is that long passphrase.
Because it's encrypted. And so without the key to decrypt everything, it's just a bunch of nonsense.
So what LastPass actually stores is a bunch of nonsense. They give you an account, a username and a password. Normally they use their email address and a password. That password's not the same as the vault encryption password. It's just the way that you connect to the service so you can actually get this big blob of stuff. Because LastPass does not want to know how to decrypt your data. Because if they did and someone hacked in, they could do that. And they can't. So in some regards, because of the design, and that's called, what's it called?
Trust no one is one of the terms I've heard seen.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. TNO. So that concept is I'll have a long passphrase that I use to encrypt my data. Then the software, the LastPass stuff, takes that, uploads it using my email and password for them, which I have to know as well, and then stores it on their service. And then with my phone, it downloads it there, and my other laptop, it downloads it there. Or I can give my wife my password information, and she can download my pass vault. So what happened with LastPass in this hack, and by the way, handled it well, I think, is that somebody got in and actually was able to get all of the emails, the hashed, salted hashed passwords and unique salts for every user, which is unfortunate.
They got the salts?
They got the unique salts for the users, yeah. Because normally it's on the same kind of
environment. It doesn't really matter. They're not going to run through the
Should we go in salts?
Billions of
we
years.
We shouldn't go in salts
No.
Right now.
It just means that they can't have the password system set up to crack it pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's think of it just as another layer of protection, mathematical protection maybe.
So I feel like we need to make this like a teaching educational moment because we've had in the news in the past few months government officials talking about passing laws requiring a backdoor is the way some people describe
it.
Basically requiring some sort of second key that would be held by some authority that the government could use to unlock that blob because that they fear that too many bad people can encrypt things without the government being able to get into it. So I just think this is a great example that if that did exist, then the hackers might have a second way to get into that blob. So
and it's the same argument with LastPass not wanting to know how to decrypt your stuff.
That's
right?
The great thing. That's right.
So if nobody but you can decrypt your stuff, not even the service that you're hosting your stuff on,
that's right.
They can't even decrypt your stuff, then you're pretty safe, right? The reason that they don't want to be able to decrypt your stuff is the same reason that the government wants to be able to decrypt your stuff. But like you said, if someone other than you can decrypt your stuff, then they're a target. And if someone compromises them, then they can decrypt your stuff
too. To be fair, it's not the government that wants to be able to have a backdoor. It's law enforcement that wants to have a backdoor to be able to do their job better. So the argument is nuanced. I think all of us are on the side of no, that's really bad. That would break security. That would break privacy and break encryption horribly if you did that. Additionally, it wouldn't stop anything because it is trivial to take one of these open programs that doesn't have a backdoor and make a secure way of communicating. So if I can do it, but you make it illegal, then the people that want to do it will do it anyway, and the people that don't won't. I mean, it just makes everybody – it's really bad. Yep. Anyway, though, with LastPass, what they're recommending, if you do have a LastPass account, please do go and log in and change your password. That is crucial because what could happen is somebody could potentially – they have your email address, which is really unfortunate. They could potentially take the salted hash, and if you had a weak password, they could run through and try to break your login password, though it's unlikely, but then they could take over your account at some point. This doesn't mean they get access to your passwords, but it does mean that you wouldn't have access to them anymore, which would be bad.
Do users still have their blob on their computer that they could use to get to their passwords?
Yeah. Normally it's synced up and you have it accessed locally. The syncing is really the only thing that occurs through the service that you need the username and password. So if you're using LastPass, do go change your password. I'm sure LastPass has already emailed you. Just find that email. And then don't click on it. Instead, go to LastPass website, which is probably LastPass.org.
And this is just another reason to have two-factor authentication turned on too. So that way, if you try and log in and then it asks you for your key and you, in fact, are a hacker trying to access someone's account, then you won't have that key.
Don't you feel like sometimes we're kind of doctors when there's a sick patient? You should have eaten your vegetables. It's like, people know this, but at the same time, it's not like, I don't know.
Yeah, but I talk to people all the time that they've heard this stuff, but they just don't get it.
Right. You should back up your software, too. Back up things, please, too. Please back things up.
Yeah. Back things up. Let's talk about passwords and backups.
Passwords and backups.
I mean, those are like the most common reoccurring stories that we talk about.
We also talk about really cool transportation methods like robotic cars and hyperloops and things
like that.
Oh,
that's true. Yeah,
Can we do that this time too?
Yeah, sure. All right, so I'm tired of talking about robotic cars, but I will talk about hyperloops and SpaceX, which is, of course, one of our favorite companies.
Wait, SpaceX and hyperloops? How do they connect?
SpaceX and hyperloops. So,
can I do the hyperloop thing real quick?
What was that?
Hyperloop is a transportation methodology, which is like a train in a tube, and the tube has been evacuated of air, so the train can go really, really fast, like San Francisco to Los Angeles in an hour or less.
Yeah, or like that thing at the bank that we used to see back in the 80s.
Yes. And that's the story.
No.
No, I'm kidding. There's a bit more. So in the summer of 2012, Elon Musk, who leads SpaceX and a bunch of a bajillion other things, offhandedly mentioned apparently he was working on, quote, a fifth mode of transportation, and people were like, huh? What's that? Come on, tell us. So eventually in August of 2013, he and some SpaceX engineers drew up a white paper, a very detailed white paper, describing this thing, a hyperloop, right? And the idea is that if you built it, let's say, between Los Angeles and San Francisco, a drive that would normally take 5 hours if you're speeding, you could do it within 35 minutes or so, which is really, really fast. That's like 700 miles an hour fast.
But Ben, on the August 24th episode of GeekSpeak, 2013, August 24th, we talked all about the Hyperloop.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You really do have an... Either that or if you have Google.
No.
So the news is that SpaceX... Oh, actually, before I tell you that news... After that white paper was released, and it was really quite detailed, two different companies started work on commercial hyperloops. SpaceX is claiming that they don't really care if other people build it. So, that's pretty cool. And SpaceX is actually going to build a much smaller version of this for testing out pods. And what they said is, quote, they want to do this in order to accelerate the development of a functional prototype and to encourage student innovation. SpaceX is moving forward with a competition to design and build a half-scale Hyperloop pod, which sounds awesome. So you could go and, you know, get an engineering team together and build a little half-scale Hyperloop pod and test it on their track and everything. And the goal is to try to make things that are, you know, better than
a pod
planes.
That fits in their track.
Yeah, better than planes and better than trains.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
I'd love that idea. Also, by the way, from the white paper, here's a quote. The pressure of the air inside the Hyperloop is about 1/6 the pressure of the atmosphere on Mars.
Oh, that helps a lot.
That didn't help me a lot. I don't remember the atmosphere on Mars. So I had to look it up, and it turns out atmosphere on Mars is about 100 times thinner than Earth's. So we're talking pretty vacuum-like, but not quite a hard vacuum because they're expensive and hard
to maintain.
This is not the hypertransportation
technologies group that is making a 5-mile one.
This is SpaceX themselves.
Whoa, so two different groups are doing this.
Yeah.
If you want to learn more about the 5-mile Hyperloop track that will cost about $100 million, you can listen to Live Long and Prosper Net Neutrality, the 2015 February 28th episode where Bonnie talks a lot about that.
You're all writing these numbers down, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, I'm actually saying also like, that Chandler will take them and link them to the show. Well, it's like just like the most linked episode ever.
I was going to say, like, this episode will effectively be like 6 hours long if you have to listen to all of it.
This week of Geek Speak brought to you by every previous week of Geek Speak
for 15 years.
And the letter U.
Udacity? No.
Oh, no.
That's all I think of.
No, I'm just thinking about Sesame Street.
As you do.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
Shall we talk about some online privacy? Mr. Brian Young.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So do you feel like your privacy is upheld on the internet? Do you feel like you have any privacy?
No. I know I don't have any privacy.
And do you feel like you should have privacy?
On the internet?
Yeah, yeah.
Should? Yes, there's some level that I would like privacy.
So everybody has certain expectations when they go and they use a card at a store or they give some information to their insurance company.
Sure.
Or something like that. That has been codified into laws and so on. But on the wild, wild west of the internet, we tend to think of anything you put out there is going to be public no matter what.
It's a good way of thinking about
it. Even if you think it's behind a password or so on.
Even if it's in a private email to a friend.
So, and people look at all these people on Facebook that are putting up their most private details and wondering, well, do Americans really have any desire for privacy at all?
Hmm.
So somebody decided to do a study over at the University of Pennsylvania, if I've got that right. And they wanted to ask a few questions to Americans to find out what they really think about privacy and what they really expect. So let's see if you agree with this statement. If companies give me a discount, it is fair for them to exchange. It is a fair exchange for them to collect information about me without my knowing.
So this was the survey.
Yeah. Do you agree with that? Is it fair for them to take your information without you knowing?
If I do what?
If they give you a discount and you purchase something with that discount.
Do you know that they're going to take your information without your knowing?
Without you.
But see, I know that they do use that information. That's what promo codes are for. Promotional codes and coupons, the only purpose of them is to track the individual to find out where you're spending your marketing dollars and how you're making money.
Generally. Also, maybe to get you in the store.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean, that's a big piece of the promotional code, right? Like, that's what the point of it is, to complete the loop of tracking people's source. Not individuals necessarily, but where the revenue is coming from.
Yeah.
But you're right that no, it's not. I don't think everyone thinks that way.
It's fair for an online or physical store to monitor what I'm doing online when I'm there in exchange for letting me use the store's wireless internet or Wi-Fi without charge.
I mean,
okay.
If it's upfront and clear, then yeah, and then I would just choose not to
but
use
see,
it.
Just
the
use,
problem is you're
just
savvy.
Use a VPN and have HTTPS the entire time. You're totally fine.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
God. Lyle, come on now.
So you subvert the system.
So the problem is you're completely savvy about this and you see
yes,
through what the motivations
absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely.
But many people out there are not savvy about it.
And I bet people don't like this, do they?
No, no. In this statement, when it was asked to the 1,500 people of the survey.
Wow, that's 70, a good size.
Yeah, it was a good size survey. 71% disagreed. Half of them strongly disagreed with that statement.
Were they told afterwards, well, that's happening?
That would be fair, but no, I don't think they were.
It's a scientific study. Wow. So people don't agree with what they're already agreeing to.
Yeah. So we have a culture that's built up around all of this marketing that the marketers...
Consumerism, I think it's called.
Yeah, exactly. Marketers are taking this information. And Americans don't want it to happen. They don't like it. And yet, our behavior does not show that at all.
Yes.
What our behavior shows is that
we
do it willy-nilly. So what the researchers were trying to dig into is what's going on here. And it's just it's a plain disconnect. Most people feel like they have no power at all to change this. And the marketers already have their information anyway. So what's the sense in holding back anymore?
Hmm. It's throwing out the baby with the bathwater. But I see the reasoning. I don't logically agree with it, but I see the reasoning is like, hey, you know what? I'm kind of screwed anyway.
So we're running a bit out of time. This is kind of sad that people don't know. Yes, when you use services, people are taking advantage of you. That's so depressing. Let's move on to something a little more exciting about technology, like robots or something. Ben, can you please?
Yeah, I've got a quick one, okay, which is a little robotic tentacle. It's a soft robot developed
by...
You've
got some time, man. Breathe.
Jayoung Kim from the Iowa State University and his colleagues. And it's this little teeny tentacle thing.
Like a tentacle. Is it mini-jointed tentacle? No.
It kind of looks like a noodle or something.
Well, here, I mean, all right.
I'll show you a picture of a little ant who's caught in the tentacle. Okay, so
this is just a picture of an ant wrapped with a piece of string.
Right, but it kind of looks like a piece of fiber optic cable or something.
Okay,
kind of clear. But it's very, very small. So the cool thing about this soft robot, as they're calling it, this is not like a robot that walks around, but it's a little tentacle, and it can curl itself into a circle with a radius of 200 micrometers.
Ben, that sounds awesome. What is it for? I mean, controlling ants?
Probably something a bit more like microsurgery, so interacting with very, very small things like blood cells or little clots or things like that.
Like tying off a vein. I could see it could squeeze a ventricle or something.
Right, yeah. There's a little picture of it interacting with the egg of a fish, and usually if you try and use tweezers to do that, they deform and they burst.
Yeah, and slippery little suckers. Oh, but this thing can squeeze it from all the way around.
It can squeeze it all the way around, and also it's very, very low force.
By the way, the ant reminds me a lot of Chewbacca because he's got that thing wearing across his chest, the little robot.
I would be really upset if I was that ant.
Yeah, it looks a little scary.
Like, what's going on?
Neal Stephenson is a seminal sci-fi or speculative fiction author with a collection of fantastic stories behind his belt. Snow Crash and Diamond Age are my favorites, but he also has a baroque of other things, including the title Baroque. But in any case, he's also a software developer, programmer, game designer, and he's even works with Blue Origin, a company that recently launched a rocket into space. He is their futurist, if you will. So he does some pretty incredible things. Neil's most recent book is Seven Eves, an interesting story about the human race's catastrophe of the moon blowing up and destroying the planet. And Neal Stephenson, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, Lyle.
Hi, Neal. Thanks for doing this.
Sure.
The moon blowing up is a nice, harsh slap in the face to the human race in your book, and definitely gets people motivated in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
We have disasters happening slowly right now, and yet we don't seem to motivate as a society.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit tricky creating a space arc book, because the disaster has to be bad enough to kill everyone, but it can't be a kind of slow rolling thing that slips under our attention span,
mm-hmm.
Or that's deniable, that's arguable. So to write this book at all, I had to come up with something that was just so obvious nobody could argue with it, and that was going to have an inevitable result.
Yeah. Do you have a negative feeling on politics? I think you paint the political animal in a pretty negative light in this book. It feels to me that way.
I think what you've got in this particular story is a case where the engineers and the nerds who go there first, go to the yard first, are thinking strictly in terms of what do we need to get done on a technical level. And the politics kind of sneaks up on them. It's not a thing they're wired to think about. You know, they like to believe that you can live in a world that doesn't have such things,
mm-hmm.
And that's not the case. So, I mean, you could kind of make an analogy to Microsoft and the trouble that it got into years ago around the antitrust I can't remember if it was a lawsuit or...
Right. The battle in the court about merging the browser into the operating system and whether that was a monopoly play.
Yeah. That was a case where these guys in Seattle who were sort of very brilliant technically just wanted to be left alone so that they could make stuff and run their company and didn't want to concern themselves with politics. But eventually they found out that politics was definitely a concern with them. So this is loosely analogous to that, where politics happens. And I actually, although the politician types in this book are depicted in a generally negative way, I don't think you can have a human organization without politics.
Yeah.
So
hence the necessity to have them in there. So, you know, you have this political figure, the president figure, come into the book in kind of a shocking way and really modify the human species, and actually define a new species that takes the qualities of the politician's sneakiness, if you will, and embeds it into the genome of that species.
I would take issue with the description of the trait as it's embedded. So her own self-description of what she's doing is that she's kind of thinking about the big picture all the time. She's sort of thinking ahead. She's envisioning possible outcomes. She's strategizing, and that this is a thing that that you have to be able to do. You can't have a civilization without people who have those qualities. And she sort of admits that in her case, it took her down the wrong path. And so the journey she has to go on is to figure out, you know, hey, wait a second. Look, it's what I am isn't inherently bad.
Yeah, I mean, she celebrates it, right? She claims that it's a positive quality. But at the same time, the next time you really see the final outcome of her race, that it's still painted in a pretty negative way.
Well, that's a little bit of a plot twist on my part, right? So you're kind of set up to expect that the next one you meet is going to be more positive,
right?
And then it doesn't work out that way. But I think in a broader portrayal of that civilization, you would find that most of the
Julians.
Most of the Julians are contributing to the civilization in a positive way,
yeah.
And that the character you're talking about is just the rare bad one that makes all of the others look bad.
Right, right. So while the cloud arc separates from the main body, if you will, and they take off with her, the downfall of that is painted very much in the light of falling into the social media wasted time. There's actually discussions about Tav getting this place where he's, you know, using his computer, I would say, very much like a person in the current day uses their computer. And that is a major downfall of the majority of the human populace. Are you painting a picture about what our social media currently is and what it means?
Well, I'm not a big fan of ramming messages down people's throats. So I don't, I don't want to, I like to think of it in terms of here's my message you must read and understand. It is a common observation among people who use social media now that it changes, you know, it's addictive, it changes the way you think, it takes a lot of time that you might be able to spend doing something else. And so, in fact, just today between interviews, I was looking at Twitter and saw an announcement by somebody that they were going to scale back their use of Twitter quite a bit because this person didn't like the way it was affecting how they thought, how they emoted. So people are always simultaneously using this stuff and agonizing about whether they use it too much or whether it's, you know, like it's good for me, but my uncle Fred gets too many crazy, you know, posts from from the other Fox News watchers or whatever, so it's not good for him. So there's all kinds of angst right now about social media, and I'm not trying to make a huge point about it, but I'm trying to reflect that reality in the actions of some of these characters.
Okay, so what have you, who have you been reading lately, Neil?
Well, right now, the thing I've been reading most is Bleak House by Charles Dickens.
Oh, nice.
So that's a...
There's a television series recently about that in BBC.
Yeah, somebody mentioned that to me, so yeah. I'm going to wait until I've read the whole thing.
Yeah, finish the book first. Do you recommend?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's a big thing, and it rambles all over the place in a way that would probably be frowned on now, but... You know, I find it to be immensely appealing, all these characters being introduced out of nowhere in the middle of the book and very aptly summed up in a few lines and just very witty descriptions of everything.
Let me ask you a quick question about the book. Julian, the president, she should know a lot about what's going on, what's planned, especially in her own military. Does she know about the plan that will then become the Pingers?
She would have to.
Yeah.
You know, I don't go into much depth with this book, but she would have to.
Yeah. The one other thing I feel it's kind of shocking to see a future portrayal of the human race move to such a small amount of people and then expand out from that and still embedded in what we are is war. Do you find that that's just a trait we will never get away from? It's just too much of what we are?
Well, you kind of see that in the sort of original sin of at the very beginning of Aida and the way things go with her, she knows that she's never going to be accepted.
Yeah.
Her whole mentality around her offspring is that they're going to have to live in a world where they're hated.
Yeah, and therefore prep for that.
Yeah.
That's her entire motivation, actually. Yeah.
Right. So which to me, I mean, to me that rings true as if you look at, you know, there's a lot of places where in kind of stubborn trouble spots around the world where you've got a group of people who just feel permanently aggrieved and convinced that they're never going to be accepted. And so that's, you know, that's the way that they think and it's the way that they live. It's conflict. It's occasionally it breaks out into something you could call a war, but it's more like the wars that we have, you know, since the
stable wars.
Stable wars, the asymmetrical wars, nobody's using WMDs, so it tends to be more sort of personal combat and it tends to happen kind of out of the view of the general public.
Yeah. And I love the you pull into this a whole bunch of humanoid races, right? This idea that it seems like a Star Trek and Star Wars and, of course, the classic fantasy have these separate races. And it's really neat to see that come out. I was surprised to see that emerge.
Oh, good. Well, I hope it was a pleasant surprise.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's it's a really curious feature of both fantasy and sci-fi that the, you know, multiple humanoid races that can all talk to each other
and interbreed
is damn near universal. You sort of can't have. You can't have science fiction without aliens, and you can't have fantasy without elves and dwarves and so on.
Yeah. Well, Neil, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me as well. Take care.
Yeah, thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, it was a pleasure speaking with Stevenson. I didn't tell Neil that I wasn't that happy with the book, actually. I don't give it a high praise like I do some of his other books. Seven Eves, for me, just ends in a little kind of trite way, a little odd way. There's some surprises for me that I felt were too much foretelling that it might occur and a little too fanciful for my taste. Most of the entire book seems extremely right on target of what could happen, besides, of course, the magical event of the moon blowing up. But other than that, it seems to go forward pretty well with regards to how things might work. In preparing for this, I went ahead and read his book, his collection of short stories called Some Remarks, which is a wonderful collection. I didn't know that Stevenson is so embedded in the actual tech industry. He's a real geek. Neil's a programmer, and he has a whole bunch of information about working while on a treadmill desk, which I think is fascinating. Neil also did a whole bunch of work for Wired magazine, traveling all the world and trying to understand the transcontinental fiber network and how that was being built. And it's a wonderful story in an interesting epoch of time, right around the 2000 era. And so it was neat to see him look at large human works and what it was like to travel in the world, seeing how communication was being built up, how the planet was being wired. That story is actually Mother Earth, Mother Bound, but you can find the entire collection in Some Remarks, his collection of short stories. He, of course, is known very well for Snow Crash, a seminal book in sci-fi, and also Diamond Age, a book that defines a whole different way of thinking about nanotechnology, but also about the human species in general and how we raise our children and how we might interact with high intelligent computer systems. So Neil's work is fantastic. This one book, I'm not so impressed by, Seven Eves. I personally didn't like it. But do let me know what you thought of his books and his works. You can email the Geeks, of course, at geeks@geekspeak.org. Hey, thanks for listening to this special episode, if you will, of GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the Geeks sent you. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at kospe.org. To find out more about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. You can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org, or contact us on Twitter at kospgeeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxel with Ben Jaffe, Brian Young, and thanks to our intern Chandler and our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley. And thank you all for being a part of the June 20th episode of GeekSpeak 2015. We'll see you next week. Bye.